Well, good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. We're going to be going to England this morning, ancient England, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years back in time, to connect to an event which occurred in the last few days in, of all places, Washington, D.C. You know now, for the last week or two, we've been following the accelerating political progression of U.S. government suddenly, out of the blue, yeah, right, taking the whole UFO phenomenon seriously. Well, tonight, based on research that Georgia Lambert has done, who will be joining us in the third hour, and fascinating new research by Maria Wheatley, who will be joining us momentarily, we're going to knit these two apparently disparate phenomenon together. And wait till you see what we come out with, all right? But to start, we're going to go do some news. I want to, for all you who are new to the show, and we're constantly adding people and subtracting people and adding more people, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our homepage, that's our URL. And tonight's banner at the very top, which is really elegant. I mean, it, you know, visually these banners are just something, you know, to behold. It says Ancient Messages Amid the Stones with Wheatley and Lambert as the guests. So you click on that, that takes you to the guest page. And right under the guest page, right under the big banner that says to listen to the show, you'll see fast links to items. Click on my name, Richard, and that will take you to my section of Radio with Pictures. And there, item number one, again, we're starting with La Palma. And if you've been following the show, you know why. For those of you who are brand new, La Palma is a little island off the northwest coast of Africa, which is erupting. Hasn't done anything in the last 30 plus years. And suddenly in September, it started doing its thing. Well, tonight it has reached the level of the largest lava eruption from La Palma, from the volcano, in the last 500 years. The last time this much lava flowed from the vents near the apex of the volcano was in the 1500s at some point. You can do the math. Again, the reason any of this is important is that there is a low probability that La Palma could give us a stunning, shocking, catastrophic surprise, i.e. about half the island, if this eruption increases, or if the gas pressure and magma pressure underground increase, or there is significant seismic activity from moving lava underground, there's a small probability that the island will finish splitting in two, which began back in the eruption in, I believe, 1949. And half of the island could slide into the Atlantic Ocean, which, according to some geophysical models, the first ones published on this scenario were, I think, back in 2001, you could have what's called a mega tsunami spreading all across the Atlantic, north into Europe, east into the African coast, southwest into the Caribbean and the northern coasts of South America. And needless to say, that would be a very bad hair day for everyone. Now, the good news is, because of that link, if you put this on your phone, you will get alerts as to seismic activity and major eruptions, and those alerts should dictate what you do next. If there is a, you know, like an 7 or an 8 earthquake, that half of the island could come loose. If the island swells like a souffle due to underground pressures of the magma moving upwards from the mantle, it could do the same thing. And that would create potentially this extraordinary tsunami. So you should have, if you're on the rim of the North Atlantic Basin and in the Caribbean or in any of the low-lying areas around the coast of northern South America, you should have a go bag packed. And when your phone says, whoops, La Palma's doing something really weird, you should leave Dodge. You should head inland and go as high as you can go. On the east coast of the United States, we have the Appalachians. They're like 100 plus miles from the coast. Remember that scene in Deep Impact where the kids were on the motorbike or the motorcycle and they kept climbing and climbing and climbing the foothills of the Appalachians and the wave kept following and following and following. Well, that would happen about 9 hours after whatever events happened around La Palma happened. So, again, this is a low, low probability, but it's not zero. And I know there are some news stories out there saying that this concern with La Palma is, you know, another fear porn thing. It's overblown. It's just for clickbait, et cetera, et cetera. Not here. Again, low probability events have a nasty way, if you give them enough time, of happening. And now we've exceeded the 500-year record of the amount of lava, the number of thousands of cubic meters of lava that La Palma has spewed forth. So eventually, with anything physical or geophysical, it's only a matter of time. Item number two, we're going to be talking a lot this morning about this rather astonishing conference that was held on November 10th at the National Cathedral in Washington, the Our Future in Space Conference, which had a really interesting roster of luminaries ranging from the current head of NASA, Bill Nelson, to Jeff Bezos, who just launched Bill Shatner, Captain Kirk, into space and brought him safely home. Dr. Avi Loeb, who's the guy from Harvard who is now setting up a listening post on the roof of the physics lab at Harvard to listen to and monitor UFOs. I mean, come on, Harvard places. We are in totally new territory. If not, Rod, thank you. The Twilight Zone itself. Oh, and then there was Dr. Avril Haines. I think she has a doctorate, maybe not. She is the current DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, which was a government post created to kind of coordinate 16, 17, or 18. They keep adding them so I lose track. I think it's now 18 separate intelligence agencies gathering information all over the planet for the U.S. government. This all funnels through Ms. Haines, and she in turn reports to the president and gives him a daily briefing as to what is going on both on and now apparently off the planet that could concern the United States. Well, Ms. Haines, if you now go down to item number three, item number two is the two-hour YouTube video of the conference. I strongly recommend, pending some rather remarkable developments that will be occurring here around all of this in the next few weeks, I may be able to announce something significant, I mean really significant, next weekend on Saturday night's show. So you're going to want to tune in because I may actually be able to tell you something kind of mind-boggling. And as you know, since I deal with this stuff day by day by day, for me to say it's mind-boggling, well, it's probably mind-boggling. And I guarantee you, when we can talk about it, this all the pieces fit, and we're working very hard behind the scenes to make something astonishing and mind-boggling happen. If I can announce it next Saturday night, I guarantee you, you will need to get new socks. It will take your socks off. Will knock your socks off. So get ready for that. Anyway, item number two is the conference, which is going to be part of that conversation a week from last night, leading to item number three. I mean, if you haven't noticed, there is this dramatic shift going on regarding the position of the U.S. government vis-a-vis not only just UFOs, but something even more far out. Because remember, UFOs are not equal to extraterrestrial visitations. A UFO is a sighting where the observer does not know what's caused the sighting. It could be a meteor. It could be, and it has been many times, you know, like Venus. People don't know the sky anymore. Or it could be a genuine extraterrestrial or even interdimensional vehicle. Did I say that? Yes, I did. Okay. Well, Avril Haines at this conference, item number two. In item number three, there is a remarkable story in The Hill, which is kind of like the Capitol Hill newspaper that reports all the good stuff. And when it's in The Hill, you know it's kind of officialese for the positions of the Congress, the executive branch, the Supreme Court. If you read it in The Hill, it's been vetted again and again and again. You don't get in The Hill unless God knows how many eyes have seen it and signed off on it. So in The Hill newspaper for Capitol Hill, the official paper of, in essence, the U.S. government, only one step closer would be the Congressional Record. It reports on Ms. Haines' comments regarding the current U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force observations vis-a-vis UFOs. In fact, let me quote exactly. Ms. Haines, on the afternoon of November 10th, the evening of, said, and I quote, "The main issues that Congress and others have been concerned about is the safety of flight and counterintelligence issues. Always, there's also the question of, is there something else regarding the UAP UFO phenomenon that we simply do not understand, which might come extraterrestrially?" She said it, extraterrestrially. This is light years beyond any official position of the U.S. government on this phenomenon for the last, 60, 70 years, since 1947, when the Air Force called press conferences and poo-pooed the entire thing. And, you know, then there was another press conference in the 60s where they termed them swamp gas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of this is leading to item number four. This is now from Politico, which is an exterior website which follows, the turgid, arcane politics of Washington. Believe me, they're very arcane. And so when you see it in Politico, it's almost as good as seeing it in The Hill. Anyway, in Politico, there is a story regarding Dr. Kirsten Gillibrand, who was leading a bipartisan group of senators to make amendments to the current National Defense Authorization Act, which is how we spend government money every year, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. I think the DOD budget now annually is something like $700 billion and climbing. Anyway, as part of that budget appropriation that is going to work its way through the Senate now that a version of this has been passed in the House, Ms. Gillibrand has formally proposed with her Republican colleagues that there be established under the Department of Defense an entire office devoted to the analysis, the exploration, the mitigation, the political ramifications of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, of UFOs. And it's really interesting what she says in the piece. As soon as it comes up here, let me do a couple things here. Okay. If you scroll down to the bottom of the piece, she says, the first question I got when I got on the Intelligence Committee, this was from her sons, was, "Mom, tell us about the aliens." I go, Gillibrand says, "I know nothing about it," she recalled. "I'm getting the coolest, mom jersey for sure this year. Indeed, she's clearly enjoying her role, joking. This, of course, is the one I would disagree with because I don't think it was a joke at all. Joking how Congress oversight may lead to a congressional delegation visiting new destinations or dimensions. I mean, come on, folks. This is a U.S. senator, you know, from a very conservative part of Upper New York State who's basically talking about, you know, a scenario right out of Stargate SG-1 where we send ambassadors to some other planet or some other dimension in response to them sending something or someone. Did you ever think you would hear or see or read, particularly in Washington, of anything so extraordinarily bizarre and right out of the Twilight Zone? Well, at the risk of sounding slightly pompous, I think I've been saying for the last several years that I told you so. This is coming. The subject that used to be confined to these hours of the wee mornings before dawn now are encompassing mainstream news 24/7. So fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a very bumpy and extraordinarily interesting flight. And I have no idea where we're going to land. Gosh, ambassadors to another planet of the mouth of a U.S. senator in the 21st century. Which brings me to ancient terrestrial history. Because as we laid out last night on last night's show, and if you're not a member of Club 19.5, you better join quickly and listen to last night's show. It's a critical prelude to what is coming. Because someone, and I had two of them on last night, actually I had four of them on, have opened hailing frequencies with some of the folks who are dropping in. And this is repeatable experimental engineering and science. And we're going to be discussing more of this in the coming weeks. But until then, one of the key takeaways is we now have established in the numbers. Remember, it was this Victorian astronomer, Sir Arthur Eddington, who said many, 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 many decades ago in the early part of the 20th century, gentlemen, he said gentlemen because scientists at that time were mostly men, not women. He said, gentlemen, you do not have a science until you can express it in numbers. Well, last night's show was filled with critical, important, essential numbers. And those numbers take us all the way to ancient megalithic England, among other places. Which, of course, is why tonight we have Maria back with us. Maria Wheatley is a second-generation dowser, European master dowsers, her late father, and she Chinese geomants. She's a leading authority on geodetic earth energies, ley lines, and stone circles. Maria is an accomplished author of many books on sacred sites and dowsing. In 2015, she made a major discovery. In the Neolithic period, there was a royal priesthood of long-skulled, elongated people that made Stonehenge their spiritual center or capital. Across Europe and the British Isles, this enigmatic, long-lost civilization designed elongated-shaped monuments to, in Maria's model, reflect their skull shape. During the early Bronze Age, the long-skulled people were murdered by round-skulled people who designed round stone circles and created round barrows for their departed, reflecting the shape of their own skulls. Maria tracked down the long, elongated skull of the High Queen of Stonehenge and many others to reveal this secret history of Stonehenge. Anyway, there's a whole bunch more on her bio there on the other side of midnight. But without further ado, Maria, welcome back to the other side of midnight.
Hi, Richard.
Good morning. It's really early in the morning over there, right?
It is. It's about sort of 20 past five in the morning.
Oh, dawn. My favorite time sometimes. I mean, I always see it from the other side. So what is your reaction to find, as you're going to hear in great detail in about 2 hours, that there is this extraordinary connection that Georgia Lambert has laid out between this current insane UFO phenomenon developing in the nation's capital here and the ancient moors and highlands and megalithic sites of ancient Britain?
Yes, it's very intriguing, and the ancient sites do play a role, you know, in the past and the present, and I believe in the future as well.
Well, that's where we're going to live, as Criswell used to say, spending the rest of our lives. So you have some major new developments that you were on the Halloween show. You just at the very end laid out something so remarkable that I thought we might start there. What was the new news? Give us some context, and then if you can, kind of relate to what I'm thinking tonight, which is there's this extraordinary fundamental foundation between the ancient Britons, our ancient terrestrial Neolithic civilizations, and what's going on far, far upstairs.
Yes, well, as you know, Richard, I've been researching Stonehenge for many years now, and looking at some of the older reports that the early antiquarians around about the sort of 1700s, 1800s, and 1900s looked into a lot of the barrows and monuments that surround Stonehenge. And they used to write reports about them, and they get filed away in museums and etc. And in looking at some of these reports, I noticed that a long barrow situated quite close to Stonehenge on the northern side of the monument was one of the most intriguing reports I've ever read. And I've read most of the reports about the long barrows of Stonehenge.
For people who have no idea what you're talking about, do we have images in your section of Radio with Pictures that can show what a barrow looks like, what the various barrows look like?
No, but I'll describe one. If you imagine a long barrow, which was built with orthodox dating about 5,500 years ago, is a long earthen mound, some of them up to about 390 feet long, on average about 150 feet long. So imagine like the top of the roof of a house, and that's how the barrows were on the Salisbury Plain.
So they'd be basically as long as a small ship.
Yep, some of them were very long. About 390 feet is the longest on the Salisbury Plain.
Okay.
Inside of which you sometimes had megalithic chambers, like at West Kennet Long Barrow. So imagine that there's sort of small rooms, as it were, like caves on the inside. Sometimes they were megalithic, as in West Kennet Long Barrow.
So these long structures are also mounded up. The earth was piled up. Was it brought in from someplace else?
No, each side of the mound, you have flanking ditches that were quite deep where they used to get the material from.
So either
side, you'd had a very, very deep ditch. And because we're in chalk downlands beneath the small amount of soil we have here, it's brilliant white chalk. These monuments would have been brilliant chalk white.
Oh, my.
So they would have looked quite stunning, a bit like how the Great Pyramid of Giza was finished off in limestone to make it brilliant white. The same was going on here with chalk, and it was smoothed off, so it would look very smooth, and would have lasted brilliant white for about sort of 20, 30 years.
So if they're a couple of hundred feet long, maybe almost 400 for the longest, how wide were they and how high?
Some of them were about 11 feet high, and they were quite broad. So some of them could have been about 20, 30 feet across, and some of them could have been a lot smaller than that, about sort of 15 feet across. So they varied in size and width, but they were substantial monuments that would have been visually seen for miles around because they were placed a lot of the time on elevated ground.
Oh, okay. So you have these brilliant white artificial hills.
Yes, and long, very long mounds.
Hmm. And inside they were honeycombed, you said.
Inside you'd have had various chambers. Some of them would have been megalithic in stone environs, like around Avebury Henge, which contains the world's largest stone circle. And sometimes on the Salisbury Plain, quite close to Stonehenge, they would have had timber chambers, timber rooms, and they could have been brightly painted with like ochre reds and yellows as well, the timbers out the front, so they would have looked very, very stunning to look at. And today we just see them all grassed over because they were what's called decommissioned in 2500 BC. They were infilled and finished off so you couldn't enter them again. So they were all kind of, it's called decommissioned.
Do we know why?
So my theory is because a new culture came in and changed the way in which people lived and created monuments. And they were what I call the Beaker culture. Well, they're called the Beaker culture, and they had very round skulls. These long mounds were created by the elongated skulls people going back about 5,500 years ago. Their monuments, and then they got sealed off around 2500 BC is an archaeological fact, and one that archaeologists have never addressed. They just say
really?
They're not sure. Yep, they just say they're not sure why they were decommissioned. And that's why I looked into that, because anything that's a bit of a mystery, like yourself, Richard, you look into it.
Well,
particularly
this one is huge. It's like, it's not a trivial little data point. You know, you got a huge transition. Obviously, somebody did something radically different, and they killed off their predecessors. They literally buried the predecessor monuments.
Yes. I mean, there's something big went down in prehistory, and with these monuments, just before we come up to the break, the ancients would put the long-skulled people in there in what's called burial deposits in these chambers. So the first part of using these long mounds was probably for something spiritual or something quite sacred, and then eventually they got used as long barrows to put in the burial deposits, normally the skull and the femur bones, and sometimes a whole body would go into these monuments in their second phase before they got closed down. So that's how we know there was long skull people in there, because there's a lot of records about that.
Mm.
But one particular barrow didn't contain something as simple as the long skull people, and we'll talk about that after the break. And it does
Super.
Sound something
perfect,
out of this world.
Perfect. That's what I was hoping for. My guest this morning, my first guest, is Maria Wheatley, who was a very out-of-the-box archaeologist, a dowser, has worked with the energies, the hyperdimensional torsion field that surrounds these monuments, that's amplified by them. And now we have burial chambers from two separate cultures, a real demarcation in ancient history, and the later culture, the round-headed guys, they literally sealed off and buried and tried to forget the monuments and burial sites of their predecessors. The elongated skull guys, were they both the same guys, or did the long-headed ones? Well, let's just kind of wait a moment. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and I guarantee you, ultimately, this will connect to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. We shall return.
So suddenly they discovered this thing called deuterium. They've actually shown studies that depleting the water by 30% actually makes mice thrive and grow faster, and increasing the deuterium in water by 30% kills them. So in every liter of water, there's approximately 6 drops of deuterium. Well, if we were to put 6 drops of cyanide in our water, we probably wouldn't make it. A poison is a poison. Now, this is an isotope, so this is a radioactive, but it is stable. But I believe deuterium serves many, many, many purposes. The history, really, what we should know is the globalists have an agenda. And their agenda is to keep us as dumbed down as possible, and so we don't recognize what they do and we comply. Part of the way of doing that is keeping it sick. Most water is about 155, but anything about 120 actually can affect us from literally a psychosis level and affecting our pineal gland and our pituitary gland and, of course, our right brain. So what happens is excess deuterium makes us sick. Even on the National Institute Health website, they talk about deuterium helping propagate leukemia. And that's them admitting it, because they always have to disclose their BS. That's them admitting it. So you can imagine the other things that it does to our body. We don't resonate. We don't sleep very well. I think it is the single biggest tool that the globalists, the cabal, is the biggest tool they have that puts us in a state that we don't recognize anything and we don't resonate and vibrate at the highest level possible. Hello, Lewis Herms here. Wow, what a fantastic time on the other side of the news with the Eclectic Cast. What incredible information, and I was so happy to be here.
Back everyone on this Sunday night, November 28th, from the Land of Enchantment, the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, who is an archaeologist, a dowser, and who has discovered something so astonishing that has been ignored by mainstream archaeology. Gosh, where have we heard that before? Anyway, Maria, please continue, because you're on the precipice, I think, of blowing our minds.
Yes, well, we were discussing before the break the mounds surrounding Salisbury Plain, and that they had internal chambers, and that they were investigated by early archaeologists, or antiquarians, as they're called. And most of the reports were putting back that they contained, you know, elongated skulls type of people, and they were describing the type of artifacts that were left behind, which there was few grave goods in these type of chambers. But one quite close to Stonehenge was different to any other report that I read. And it described, like I say, to the normal long-skulled burials where you'd place the skull in there or a whole body and the femur bones and sometimes the spine. That was the burial deposit. And in long barrows, you could have up to 36 or 37, 40 people placed in there. So they were like a communal way of burying people. So they weren't for the individual. They were for large amounts of people, generally speaking, especially in the south of England.
Okay, let me stop you there. When you say elongated skulls, are we talking like a head wrapping from infant into adulthood, which the South Americans did a lot?
They were quite naturally long skulled, although, and sometimes they were exaggerated through cranial deformation, but they were generally speaking a natural natural shaped skull is what is believed at this moment in time. But there's been hardly any research done apart from my own research.
Oh.
Because again,
so it's kind of like a taboo subject. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to, because they may suspect there's an answer they don't want.
Quite possibly. I mean, they are just not being looked at. They're mentioned now. I mean, since my discovery, like you mentioned in my introduction, I discovered that in 2015, and a few professors now are briefly mentioning them in their books, but they don't go into their culture. They don't go into their identity. It's just like, you know, skimmed, as it were.
So would these people, if they were not skulls, if they were, you know, flesh and blood and hair and, you know, sitting on the subway or in a taxi, would you notice them as different from us, from ordinary humans?
Yes, you would. I mean, the femur bones were measured.
Wow.
That's one thing we've got. Now, once you have a femur bone, you can estimate the height of a person. Anthropologists do that. The police would do that if they found a femur bone.
Right.
And the femur bones suggest that these people were very short in stature. So the women were about 4'11".
Oh my God.
And the men were about 5 feet tops. A very tall elongated skull people would be about 5'7". But on average, in a barrow in Dorset, for example, the men were 4'10".
Good grief.
I know. I mean, we think of that people being like ourselves, but they were quite robust in their build as well, because the bones were quite dense and quite heavy. And I was fortunate last week to go to a museum, and I was talking to one of the curators there, and I've now filmed and photographed a lot of femur bones and measured them myself. So I've had access to this. So I'm building up a really big profile of these people. So they would have looked very different to you and I in build and in look as well, especially with quite long skulls and quite narrow faces as well. So we tend to have a round face, as it were. The elongated skulled people had narrow faces and strong features as well. Like,
would they have kind of resembled Akhenaten?
Yes. I mean, again, you know, Nefertiti was not a tall person. They were quite short in height. And yes, they would have resembled that quite. They would have been a mirror image at times of one another.
Oh, my. And these people lived in the British Isles up until they didn't, which was roughly, what, 5,000 years ago?
Yes. That's right. That's correct. And they had a distinct culture by building these long mounds, which, like I say, in the first phase was probably as an initiation or something very spiritual. And then they were used as burial chambers. Then they were sealed off. That's their kind of phases in use.
Okay. So continue with the antiquarian, because obviously you found a library that had something really interesting in it.
Yes, I mean, this is the thing. If you read the old reports, then you every now and again you get a nugget and a bit of a gem. And so I was reading through the reports, and in one, listing all of the barrow contents, a bit like a catalogue, if you see what I mean. It was listing everything that was found. It was describing in one barrow, like I said, by Stonehenge, that they didn't have the normal deposits in. There were three to five long-skulled people placed in a circle so that their arms were outstretched, creating like a little enclosure, inside of which was a very strange description of a person or someone from out of this world.
So the skeletons had been laid down on their backs, right?
Now in a sitting position.
In a sitting position, but they were sitting in a circle.
Yes.
And how many were there? You said 13, 14?
Three to five, it was saying. Another report varied. One said three and another said five. So it's three or five. I would imagine it would be five to create more of a kind of
a filled-in circle, yeah.
And they
had their own long barrel all to themselves.
Yes.
Wow. So they must have been special people, rulers,
exactly.
Priests, nobles,
yeah.
Oligarchs, the upper 1% of long-skulled people, culture, whatever you want to call them. But they were the creme de la creme.
They were the creme de la creme, and they were probably the rulers, the high queens, high kings, high priestesses, high priests.
Hmm.
So you are looking at a kind of elitist
right next to Stonehenge.
Isn't that special? Oh, indeed. I mean, that would have been, you know, your prime location. You would have been linked to that monument. So we've got these five long-skulled people in a circle, inside of which was one person that was the focus of this burial. So that's unprecedented. You don't have people in the sitting position. You don't have people in circles. You just have the skull and the long bones placed into the mounds. And the description of the central person was, yes, they had a long skull. But it was very, very different. It was described as the eyes were on top of the head. The eyes were very high placed up, almost to the forehead. Yes, that's the description given, which is a bit like Lloyd Pye's Star Child. Yeah, they're much further up. So that was the kind of first report, and it was said that the skull seemed lighter than all of the rest.
I had a guest on a few days ago. In fact, I had him on again last night. His name is Michael Hall, and he's been in contact with, you know, folks out there, and he has this wonderful phrase that I'm going to keep using because it's so elegant. He says he's in contact with folks who are not from here. And it sounds to me like this special guy, was it a guy?
Gender wasn't discussed.
Ah, in this ancient, 17th century report, you said?
Yes, it was about the 1800, sorry.
Oh, so it's 19th century, okay.
Yes.
Okay, so it sounds to me like maybe this guy was not from here.
Yes, I mean the
just physiologically.
It is strange. The bones seemed different. The eye placement was very different. The weight of the bones were different, and when they were describing the actual skeleton, they said it had a tail, quite a long tail as well, a tail.
Well, oh, my, this gets curiouser and curiouser, Alice.
Yes, I mean, it really does. So now we've got a kind of being that is being described.
Was this guy in the center of the circle and the other folks were grouped around him?
So
he was some kind of really high, you know, king, you know, pope. Someone of majesty that the others were in attendance to, but but he was not like them.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. So this person was being revered. I mean, it was encircled. So that's saying that that is, you know, very important. And the antiquarians were describing this very unusual tale. So they were really stunned by this find. And I got in touch with Dr. Ted Robinson. He worked with Lloyd Pye on the Star Child Project.
By the way, you mentioned that. Why don't you refresh people who probably, you know, Lloyd is no longer with us, unfortunately.
No.
Describe the Star Child, what he found, and the lengths he went to get it analyzed in terms of DNA.
Oh, yes. I mean, he had an unprecedented find from South America. It was
I thought he found it in Mexico somewhere.
Mexico, yes, that's right. Mexico, that's correct. And it was a very it was an unusual looking skull. It had features about it, again, like its weight, and just, you know, things like that, but made it unprecedented.
But it was
and
a small.
Went,
it was like a child or an infant, right? As I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, this is reflecting what's going on in the Stonehenge environs. This person was small. I mean, we already know the elongated skull people were small in stature through the femur bones, and this person was also very, very small in stature as well, with the same kind of density of bone as the description is given.
Mm.
And what Lloyd Pye went out of his way was to try and get some DNA evidence, which is always required by the scientific community, and thought it was a hybrid being between a human and an extraterrestrial, was what he surmised as part of his investigation into this unusual being.
Hmm. Which, of course, unless it was artificially created in the lab by the fusing of the two, you know, genomes, there had to be fertility compatibility to get a hybrid, which means that the being that was mated had to have been somehow related closely enough to humans to be able to produce offspring, even if they look different. Back to my ETs are really family model, most of them.
Yes, yeah, so that's a very interesting point, and it would have been, you know, a necessity and a requirement, and I think this is what was going on at Stonehenge, that we have, you know, these elongated skulled people associated with this other creature or other being. I mean, I looked into what could cause a tail, and I got in touch with Dr. Ted Robinson, who worked with Lloyd Pye and was very, very helpful, because certain conditions like spina bifida, for example, for a human being to have that can cause a tail. But Ted Robinson looked at the report and said that he found that would be highly unlikely that was the case. And he went into medical detail regarding that. So if indeed Ted Robinson is correct, we can rule out spina bifida, although there were cases of spina bifida in the Avebury environs at West Kent Longbarrow, but none of the people that had spina bifida at the West Kennet Longbarrow had tails. So we can say, yes, that was prevalent sometimes in the ancient culture, but it didn't produce anything like this description close to Stonehenge.
Okay, if this ancient document, ancient being 19th century, was thorough and scientific, did it describe other things found with these five or six beings, including, you know, tools, you know, garments, keepsakes, artifacts, anything that would give us clues as to who these folks were and what they were doing?
No artifacts were reported or found in that barrow in the kind of Neolithic time of the long-skulled people. They very rarely left any grave goods or any artifacts in their barrows. Occasionally you'd get a shard of pottery or some tokens, like a pot. Black pots were sometimes found within the long barrows, but not like in the Bronze Age where you had a lot of finds and artifacts placed in with them. So it was a very different way of burial.
So they must have really felt that you can't take it with you.
Well, maybe that could be indeed the case. But what we do know is that there were very, very few artifacts found in the long barrows reported by any archaeological excavation.
Darn. Because they could give us all kinds of clues.
Yes, they could. The only clues that they left behind is the long barrows are associated with some of the massive ancient sites like Stonehenge. The other thing that is prevalent about the long barrows is they're always on very powerful earth energies, such as earth currents and ley lines especially. They seem to be placed on those. So one thing that I noticed about this ancient culture, the elongated skulled people, is they must have been the ones that laid down the ley system initially, because it was added to after that. By that I mean, if you imagine that these long mounds and the monuments that they created were all put onto these straight lines and grid systems, if you will, the later cultures that built other monuments, and even the Christians afterwards and other cultures, placed their monuments on those lines. So they have a historical line from like the Neolithic, the Bronze Age, Christian churches, Templar sites, etc., are on these lines. So it must have been that ancient culture that laid down the ley system to begin with.
So you're dead, and a lot of your community is dead over time, and your culture has built a long barrow which is aligned lengthwise along a ley line, which is a energy line in the earth that can be detected by sensitive humans and now with technology. And they put all these people in this kind of short memorialization of the ley line. For what purpose? Do we have any clues as to what they thought they were facilitating?
One thing that we do know about the leys is that when you look at them, the energy travels quite fast along a straight line. I mean, that's always been perceived in the ancient world, even going back to the ancient Chinese feng shui masters. Energy travels very fast along a straight line. It's the line of least resistance.
But why would you care if you are dead? If your shell, if your body, if your vehicle, your vessel is sitting in a circle on a ley line, why should you give a damn because you're not there anymore?
Well, because in the first phase of the monument's use, it was probably not used as a burial chamber.
Oh.
I think the first phase of the long barrow monuments were used differently
to
the end phase of a burial, and then they were sealed off. It's like a stone circle will have phase one, phase two, phase three, and phase four to it. They have different phases and different time spans around them. They're not just one thing.
Okay.
So I think initially the people that built them would have used them. I mean, tests have been done by authors and researchers looking into the acoustic properties of long mounds as well. They have
properties. I was just thinking of their connection in terms of what I figured out about Göbekli Tepe. I think those chambers with those tuning forks were incredibly resonant chambers designed to amplify the physics with sound. So if you have live beings gathering in these barrows in England, it means they were kind of like quasi churches or halls or places where you could develop a resonance with a higher dimensional physics, and that would impinge and change and enhance your living consciousness, maybe.
Yes, I mean, that's phase one. I mean, the evidence is there.
Ah.
And one intriguing example of acoustic properties of Long Barrows, if we go to Scotland and we go to two barrows called Campster Long and Campster Round, which are about 100 meters apart from one another. So if we imagine you've got two monuments, and one is about 100 meters from the other. If you played any sound in the Long Barrow at Campster, you know, like drumming or chanting or whatever,
mm-hmm.
And you're 100 meters away in the other barrow,
that's like
it would
300
sound
feet.
Like the sound. Yeah, so yeah, about sort of 300 feet away. That's right. The sound would come out of the floor of the other barrow.
Oh my God. So they could develop a resonance between them, like a couplet.
Yes. Yes, and that was discovered by Dr. Keating from Reading University. They did quite a few tests into that, and Aaron Watson from Reading University as well. So it's very widely documented that these monuments were in resonance to them. And we get that on the Salisbury Plain at Stonehenge. You get some monuments within 300 or 400 feet of the other. You get that at the West Kennet Long Barrow in Avebury. The West Kennet Long Barrow has its partner called the East Kennet Long Barrow, which is in visual distance and probably a little bit further away than 300 feet, but they do tend to come in pairs. You won't get one monument by itself. It'll be part of a wider environment.
Ah, they were supposed to be resonant couples. God, it would be great to measure the with the Accutron, the physics, you know, the torsion field changes. If you resonate one and you put the instruments in the other one, I'll bet it would go nuts.
I think it would go very, very off the scale.
Wow.
With these monuments. So when we think of the Long Barrows, we need to kind of think of all these different usages, all of these different ways in which the ancient people could have made their consciousness expand, have more spiritual awareness, and be communicating maybe with the earth, maybe with the stars on very different levels.
Or Maria, and we're actually coming up to the top of the hour here. Or maybe they were communicating with folks who were no longer here. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, archaeologist, pioneer, dowser. I mean, what do dowsers do? They douse the physics. They douse the torsion field. Imagine now that the field, like everything else in life and in experience and in geology and astrophysics and meteor, it's all constantly changing. What if there are periods, epochs, over many, many decades or even centuries or thousands of years where the physics goes up and down? And sometimes you don't need an amplifier to get in touch with the beyond, and at other times you do. So what do? You build a resonant amplifying chamber made of limestone, a resonant hyperdimensional material. That's why the pyramids are made of limestone. And you resonate it so when you put yourself inside, you expand your field with it and your connection to someone or someplace else. Wow. You're on the other side of midnight. We will get to the National Cathedral. We shall return. Thank you.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight for this Sunday night. Prelude to Monday morning, November 28th, here in the Land of Enchantment. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, and we're talking about the ancient hyperdimensional technologies built out of solid-state limestone, which started out as resonant chambers to enhance, in the model, living consciousness. Now, was this just for the rulers, or was it for everyone? Were they open to the general population? Did you take your turn? Did you get a number? Did you stand in line? Was it seasonal? Because we know the physics changes seasonally even now. And then at some point, these structures went from living chambers of consciousness raising to something dead and buried in the past. And that is really interesting. Why did that happen? Was it because the physics changed? Maria, what do you think?
Yes, I mean, that's an interesting fact that, you know, you've discussed. And some of the monuments were in limestone, and some of them were in chalk as well. I mean, we've got a lot of chalk.
Well, it's still calcium carbonate. It still has the same crystalline structure. It still resonates with the torsion field. And we know that because of laboratory experiments. Anyway, please continue.
Yes, that's interesting. Yes, so these monuments were, like I say, you know, they could be resonant chambers. And they also created some very unusual effects, I suggest, with some of their large mounds. So we've discussed the low-lying, although they're about 11 feet high, long mounds. And I know that you visited Silbury Hill in the past, Richard.
Oh, yes.
And did you do some torsion measurements at the hill, Silbury Hill?
Yes, there are even photographs. I got amazing readings. And on one of my visits, I actually went up top and I just lay down kind of like spread eagle the way you would make snow angels. And I put out my arms and I just lay there looking straight up with the entire mass of the mound underneath me to see if I could feel anything. And I guess I'm one of those people that don't feel. I have to look at instruments because I didn't feel a damn thing. But anyway, the instruments recorded amazing stuff.
Yes, so for your listeners, just to describe Silbury Hill.
Well, we've got a picture.
Silbury Hill is...
Actually, we've got a picture.
Okay.
I think it's snow-covered. It, in your section, it is number 9.
Yes, slide number 9, that's correct. So it's a large mound. And again, because we're in the chalk downland, it was white, brilliant chalk white. But beneath that chalk mound, and it's about 130 feet high, is a 7-step chalk pyramid. It's beneath that round, smooth veneer, so to speak. So that's, and English Heritage have finally put on their notice board that description. I've had it in my books for about 20 years.
No, wait, you mean from corings underneath that mound, that cone-shaped snow-covered, so it looks like the original limestone fragments that were brought in and dumped and piled up to create this mound. Underneath that mound, there is an actual planar pyramid, kind of like the picture above, number 8.
Yes, it's what's beneath that smooth, large mound are chalk blocks, I mean, massive chalk blocks. I mean, you're talking about sort of 20 or so feet long that created sort of like a 7-step pyramid.
Oh, my God. So they built a step pyramid and then they covered it with the rubble, you know, limestone rubble to create a mound.
Yes. Yes.
Now, do we know that the same do we know that the same culture that built the step pyramid with huge blocks? God, I'd love to see one of those. That it was the same culture that then buried it in rubble to create the sloping mound without any geometry at all.
That's a really good question that you've raised, and it could have been indeed the case. Again, we're looking at...
Well, remember, Göbekli Tepe was built, and then somebody deliberately buried it,
yes.
Like to preserve
exactly.
it. So did someone
exactly.
bury under Silbury Hill the real edifice, the real hyperdimensional amplifier, to preserve it for... Now?
Well, this is the case. It something happened where it was one type of monument and then it was transformed into another type of monument. So, but it gets even more fascinating because if we've got this chalk block creating this 7-step pyramid, on the inside of that chalk block were different layers of material. It was reported in one archaeological report of having an organic layer and an inorganic layer, an organic and inorganic layer
as
it goes up, which
wow.
is a bit like the Wilhelm Reich, you know.
Yes,
inorganic,
exactly.
Organic layer.
Well, because it was a hyperdimension, it was like an orgon, mega orgon accumulator, because orgone is the field, it's the torsion field. We're all talking about the same
yes.
stuff, okay? So, again, when you have these radical changes, like the barrows, like long barrows back to round barrows, you have cultural change, you have people changes. Did the new guys that built the barrows, the round ones, did they move in and cover up to silence, to kill, to stifle the energy in the crib, the pyramidal, huge orgone pyramid, under basically a mound of rubble?
Well, I think that could have well occurred. You know, it's very difficult to get different dates through these monuments because it's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the last archaeological excavation, I think, was around the year maybe 2000, 2005, around that time, and it's not going to be looked at and investigated anymore. More's the pity.
Well, that's kind of dumb. Who made that decision? How can you stop science?
Unless you have even the top Stonehenge archaeologists, such as Professor Mike Parker Pearson from University College London, UCL, they have to have a really good paper to say, I want to dig at Stonehenge, because otherwise they're just not allowed, actually. And Avebury has hardly had any excavations done since the 1930s.
Mm. So you got a hill called Silbury Hill. You now know,
yes.
And do they know because of corings or because of seismic surveys or ground penetrating radar?
They've used ground penetrating radar, and they have used coring, and also in the 1960s, you had Professor Richard Atkinson, and he created a tunnel, which was an existing tunnel that had been done in the 1800s to enter the center of Silbury Hill.
Right.
So, and it was filmed in the 60s.
Was it,
was
this from the top down, or was it from the side in?
From the side in.
Ah.
And it was an existing tunnel that had been created, but not kind of fully extended. Atkinson went right into the core of Silbury Hill. And what he found in one of his reports that he wrote, he said he found living moss. But this hadn't seen the light of day for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Wait, run that by me again. He found living what?
Moss. It's a kind of, you get it in damp climate.
Oh, you're saying
it's
moss,
like,
M-O-S-S. I thought you were saying moss, M-O-T-H-S. And I thought,
sorry,
oh, that's weird.
That's my English accent. I do apologize.
It's also it's basically Skype. Okay, so it was moss growing in the dark in the center of Silbury Hill.
Yes.
Now, in order for him to extend the tunnel, he had to go through the blocks and the layering horizontally of the pyramid, right? The step pyramid?
Yes.
Did he report that? Oh, guys, I kind of found a building in here.
He does report the different types of layering system, and he does say what it was constructed of, but it's not a detailed report as such.
Well, that's dumb science.
Well, Professor Richard Atkinson, when he excavated Stonehenge, he took some very interesting artifacts from the Bush Barrow. It's a very famous burial mound, and it wasn't found and rediscovered in 2005, and he did that in the 60s. He would just take artifacts. So, you know, that is not scientific of what you'd expect from a professor.
So he was acting more like an antiquarian, or some of the guys that went and pillaged Egypt and brought all the stuff to the British Museum. I wonder if this stuff that Atkinson found is hanging out in the basement of the British Museum.
I think there's a lot that has been taken and a lot that has gone missing, because it's every now and again something crops up. So, like I said, the last time was 2005 from the 1960s.
Sorry to interrupt. We don't have a lot of time. It feels like it, but we don't. This idea that the Silbury Hill is not the smooth, you know, very difficult to climb because it's slippery grass on the surface now. And of course, they have all these signs saying "Do not climb," and I had to climb it to get the reading. So, you know, I just climbed it and did the readings. And there's photographs of me doing this. So, if the Brits want to come and arrest me, feel free. Anyway, under this mound, there is this pyramid, 7-step pyramid made of huge blocks. I presume they're limestone, right?
Chalk.
Well, chalk and limestone are the same thing, basically. One is different consistency. Same chemical material, they're calcium carbonate. Do you know where they quarried these blocks to build a 130-foot high step pyramid in the middle of a plain?
There's a hill not far from Silbury Hill called Weydon Hill, and that was one of the quarries. And also it was surrounded by a very, very deep moat, which would have been filled with water all year round. Today, it only fills up in the winter when the springs fill the moat up, but originally it would have been surrounded by water.
So the moat, which is basically a ditch, would have been the source material to build the hill that covers the pyramid, right?
Some of it, and the other quarry was not that far away on what's called Weydon Hill, and you can still see a huge kind of area that doesn't grow like the rest of the hill, and that's because it was all disturbed ground beneath it. So that was believed to be one of the quarries there.
Okay, I've got a two-part question. Given that the physics of the torsion field, these solid-state amplifiers, totally changes radioactive decay rates, okay? And the okay. radioactive decay is supposed to be this immutable clock that you can use to date ancient structures. Like the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,800 years and change, almost 6,000. But not if it's buried in these structures. It will change significantly over time. So if you got some of the organics from the layers of the pyramid and you try to date using the radiocarbon method, the pyramidal age when it was built, it'd be totally off, be totally wrong. And so I wonder if they know this, because in your research, have you found, A, when they figured out there was a step pyramid buried under the hill, and B, when they estimate the pyramid was buried to conceal it?
No, there has been no dating of that at
ding,
all.
Ding, ding, ding. You know why? Because they got results they couldn't believe. They can't believe it. It's so enigmatic and anomalous. Instead of publishing, they simply buried it because they can't explain it, because their physics does not explain this. In their universal view, radioactive decay rates are constant cosmological clocks. Nothing changes them. The weather, the rotation of the Earth, the sun dying, nothing will change them. When, of course, in the real physics, which has been hidden, they're changeable all over the map. And that's what they're concealing by publishing. I mean, you'd think they'd publish a date, right?
So the date that the archaeological expert called Jim Leary says about Silbury Hill is 2480 BC. That's his timeline. But he took that from a sample. Remember I said that they're in about sort of 2000 or 2005, they re-excavated and went back into the mound.
Mm-hmm.
They took
you
some
mean
samples.
Into Atkins Tunnel?
Into Atkinson's Tunnel,
oh,
that's right.
Okay.
And a friend of mine, a late author called John Cowie, who was a Silbury Hill alternative expert, he went in with them and took his own sample for carbon dating. So you've got the archaeological date of 2480 BC by Jim Leary, and John Cowie's date was 12,000 BC.
Oh, now that's interesting, because I'd
that's
prefer,
what John Cowie
I think Cowie's data is much more accurate than the standard date. And again, they're probably both in error because of the physics.
Could well be, but that was one independent dating system.
Are you familiar with...
And I think
with
what,
go ahead.
No. You go ahead, Richard. Sorry.
Are you familiar with? I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He worked for ARE. He's now become a very prominent Egyptologist. He was put through school and university by the ARE research organization, which was the Casey organization, and he's kind of like the Carl Sagan of Egyptology. And I'm blanking on his name. Anyway, many, many, many years ago, he did sampling of the straw in the mortar of the Great Pyramid in a spiral going from the ground all the way to the top. And he sent it to several different labs. And the dates came back that the top of the pyramid was older than the bottom, which, of course, is impossible, much older. Because how do you build a pyramid apex hanging in midair without the stuff underneath it, right? But the explanation, of course, is
yes.
that the pyramids are active torsion field machines, and so they completely skew the radiocarbon dating that, of course, Mark Lehner, that's his name, Mark Lehner, that Lehner was assuming was the real physics. Well, the same thing here. Depending upon where you got your sample, you'd get a more accurate version of the radiocarbon dating of Silbury Hill. And if your friend got it from close to outside and the other guys got it from, I have a frog in my throat. If the other guys got it from near the center would be the most radically changed. The physics would play havoc with the you know, decay rate, and the sample that your friend got probably near the exterior would be more accurate in terms of real age dating. But unless you knew there was a physics problem, you'd be left with a conundrum, and everybody would just say, well, we can't deal with that. We'll just bury it, literally.
That's very interesting about, you know, where that you take samples from, which could, you know, like you say, change the whole
Well, we got Mark Lehner's documented published results, which for some reason he published. I don't know how he got it published, but it's right there in the literature. The top of the pyramid is much older than the bottom, which makes no sense at all.
No, it's very, very, very intriguing.
Well, because of obviously the physics of the pyramid and what was basically encapsulated inside. And that's a whole other program. Anyway, this is remarkable. Now, where, if one wanted to find a description, a mainstream description of this buried seven-step pyramid, where would you look? Because I've seen nothing on this. Nothing.
Well, there are a few diagrams online that if you do put in Silbury Hill, you'll come up with the image. It's a bit like it's done on one side. And in my book, I'm trying to think which one it's in. I think it's Discover in Wiltshire. I've got a really good diagram of it in there. And like I say, the latest board has this in front for everybody to see, finally.
Wow.
If we look as well, even if we do use an orthodox date of 2480 BC, which I actually think it is a lot older, but
yep.
Even if you stay on the orthodox timeline, you're in what's called the Chalcolithic period, the Copper Age.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got the Neolithic time of the Longskull people, then you've got the Chalcolithic, and then you've got the Bronze Age, and you've got the Iron Age, and et cetera. That's the kind of prehistoric timeline that is used in the archaeological models. So in the Chalcolithic period here, and what I think was going on, very similar to the Great Pyramid, which is writers like John Michel have often said that on right on the apex of the pyramid, you could have had a piece of conducting material, his model is gold, that was on the final piece at the top.
Yeah, the so-called golden capstone.
Yes, exactly. So you've got that kind of conductive material. And I think that was very similar to what may have occurred with Silbury Hill. You had a conducting material, be that gold or be that copper, that was placed on top of that monument as well. And with an engineering friend of mine who was measuring we didn't do torsion fields like you, Richard, but what we did, we looked into the electrostatic fields of Silbury Hill, and we took a control at the bottom, which was the normal reading, which was around 200 volts, which you always get anyway about 6 feet high, 1.82 meters.
Mm-hmm.
You'll always get that reading. It's quite common. And when we took the equipment, which was an electrostatic field meter, to the top of it, it was ranged at 20,000 volts. It was completely different. And what the engineer and I surmised and hypothesized is that with the electrostatic field there building up with all of these different layers of organic and inorganic acting like a high voltage capacitor, if you will, it would release the electrostatic field through the copper or the gold on top, and it would have lit up a kind of blue discharge of light. And that has actually been captured by a photographer in the area where he got some blue haze right at the top of Silbury Hill at the full moon.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is there a video of this?
Captured. He won't allow me to use that image.
What?
He allowed me to use it in one lecture, but won't let me use it in the future, unfortunately.
Why not? What did you do to him?
I didn't do anything.
Did someone come to him and say, over your dead body, you're not going to let her use that picture again?
Well, I did have permission to begin with. I did one lecture on this for the BASIS project, and then I was denied access, and I had to write a formal letter saying that I would not use it. Which was, well, anyway, but nonetheless, it got captured, releasing this, what we think was an electrostatic field. So now we've got this.
So hang on, let me interrupt again. Why can't we take our own?
Yes, I've tried on a couple of occasions to go there at night to capture it, and I haven't captured it yet, but I will continually try to do so.
Well, it's got to be when the physics, you know, remember I used the analogy, you can't surf unless surf is up. The physics has to be at a peak for you to see this, for this phenomenon to become, you know, kind of blatant.
Yes. Yes, I agree, and think that is indeed the case. So I think Silbury Hill was, you know, releasing argon into the environment because of its layering states, and I think it could have been used as well to create a light effect around it, which would have been quite stunning. You see, what's happened to the top of Silbury Hill, its summit, is when the French came to England and, you know, took over a lot of the lands here in, you know, after 1066, they sliced the top of Silbury Hill off to make it a lookout, an advantage point. So the actual top of Silbury Hill is no longer in existence to say what it actually looked like or what it contained. And if it did have any debris from a conducting material, well, that's all gone. So you can't prove either way, if you see what I mean, which is a real shame, because I think it really went far more to an apex point than we see it today as flat.
In which case, I again am very suspicious of the official story. I think someone in the know tried to kill it.
Yes. Yes, we're trying to get back the facts of how these ancient sites function.
Yep.
And, you know, the visual effects of these sites as well.
And the deeper energy effects would have been even wower. Anyway, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, and we are romping through ancient Britain, ancient technologies that somehow, and the mechanism is by way of the National Cathedral and the recent amazing UFO conference held at the National Cathedral, where the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency basically says, there's somebody out there, and we need to pay attention. And Congress is now talking about setting up a UFO, ancient alien ET office under the Department of Defense. This is getting really interesting. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, $0.33 a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
Back everyone to the other side of midnight for this Sunday night, last half hour on Sunday. My guest this morning, Maria Wheatley, is taking us in a tour de force journey back in time to a time obviously extraordinarily sophisticated ancient technology, which again, in my perspective, someone else has now been trying for the last several thousand years to systematically stamp out, decapitate, bury, silence, make everyone forget. In other words, it's almost like we were in prison. And now, is the dawn coming? Are we about to experience a renaissance, the likes of which in human memory we have never known? And will this be facilitated by someone from outside? Well, we'll talk about that in the next 90 minutes. Maria, please continue.
Yes, so what we've been discussing, that you know, that you could have these amazing light effects if the mound originally had a metal cap, as you know, it's claimed with the tops of pyramids. Particularly if pointed, you get a corona discharge caused by the ionization, which would create this amazing blue light. So when we look at ancient sites today, we're just seeing the vestiges of that which was.
The bare bones. The bleaching bones of time.
Yes, exactly so. When we know that they have acoustic properties, and you yourself know that they have energy with the torsion field, we know that their placement was significant, being joined together, as it were, by lays and by earth currents.
Is there a known lay that runs under Silbury Hill?
Is there what? Sorry, Richard?
Is there a known ley line that runs under Silbury Hill?
Yes, there's a very powerful north-south line that links Silbury to Stonehenge.
Oh, my.
But more than that, Richard, and I've investigated this for many years, this lay. It's one of the most powerful in the area because it runs north-south. But
along the meridian.
Along the meridian.
At right angles to the Earth's rotation, which is, in the physics, really important.
Right, that's really interesting. Well, there was, again, another antiquarian called Dr. Edward Duke, who used to live near Stonehenge in a very large house there. And what Edward Duke claimed that he found, or that he himself devised, was that if you take Stonehenge to be at the south, and then you get other sites along that line. For example, you have a very large Iron Age ceremonial enclosure called Casterly Camp. You have a place called Marden on that line as well before it reaches Avebury. And Marden was a superhenge. Hardly anything is left of it today, but it was a massive place with sweat lodges, with stone circles, with a mound. Now, the name is very interesting, which I'll come to in a moment, Marden. And what Edward Duke said was that the distance between all of these sites represented the planets above. So you would have Saturn for Stonehenge, you would have Jupiter for Casterly Camp, and Marden, den is an old English word for settlement and farmstead. You literally have the settlement of Mars in its name, Marden.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that place would represent Mars. Then you come to Silbury Hill, and Silbury Hill, Duke said, represented the Earth. Now, if you and Avebury represented the Sun and the Moon, and north of Avebury, Richard, used to have this amazing concentric stone circle. Only one stone survived from the 1720s stone smashing phase. And that was the Temple of Venus. So he has all of the planets laid out in a planisphere as above and so below. I showed this to an astronomer friend of mine called Lawrence Upton many years ago and said, okay, they've gone up to Saturn. If we use that line, can we find where Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto is on this planetary line? And he said it was ingenious what the ancients were doing, because they were using Silbury Hill as representing Earth, as indeed Duke said. But the distance between each of the planets represented the mean distance they were apart in the heavens above, which is extraordinary, because you think, how would the ancient people know that? Well, using that and using it as miles on the ground, if you see what I mean. You're using the mean distance above and you're projecting it at miles. So we used that system, which we think the ancients did, and we found on that line Uranus.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
No, it is very wild.
Which means, since you can't see him with the naked eye, the ancients had to be using documents, archives, libraries, scrolls, some kind of handed down heritage of knowledge, that these guys were also important in the physics.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, that is the case. You cannot see on the ground, you know, where these sites would be in relationship to another.
So how did he find them? How did he identify them?
By using the mean distance in miles of what he mathematically saw.
So he sees a piece of ground mathematically where Uranus and Neptune should be. What's there now? What's left?
That's right. So Uranus was sighted on a beautiful ancient monument called Belus Nap. It's a horned long barrow, Neolithic, 5,500 years old, orthodox dating, and it has like these kind of big crescent features at the front. It's a very, very stunning monument, and that represented Uranus. Neptune we found at Hengistbury Head. Now, Hengistbury Head is a big Neolithic and Bronze Age and Iron Age settlement with lots of monuments, and it overlooks the sea on the south coast. And that is Neptune's domain, the oceans and the sea.
Yeah, Poseidon, the ocean, seawater.
Poseidon, yes. So it was quite poetic
that Hengistbury Head,
where Neptune should be, was on the south coast in a county called Dorset. So we investigated.
Oh, that's where Graham lives. Graham Hancock lives down in Dorset.
Right. Well, he could be very close to Neptune at Hengistbury Head, for instance. So this lay is so sophisticated that it is representing the planets above.
Okay. I hate to ask, did your friend find Pluto?
Pluto, we did find Pluto, but the problem with that is, was it in a very built-up city area, which you wouldn't know what was, you know, beneath the ground.
Right.
But interestingly, many years later, a friend of mine from Wessex Archaeology was doing an emergency, what's called over here, emergency dig. That's if you've got a new store going up, you think there's something beneath the ground, something has been found by one of the building contractors, the construction has to stop, and
right,
an archaeologist has to go in. It's emergency archaeology. And quite close to that line, he's a very open-minded archaeologist that has always supported my work. And he said, I think I found your Pluto.
It was a long
barrow that was very, very deep in the ground, not on top of the ground like we expect long barrows, Richard, but it was slightly below the ground. And Pluto, its symbolism is god of the underworld.
Hades, yes,
was below the ground. So the symbolism seems to fit.
There's another aspect. You say that it's close to but not on the ley line?
It would have been on the ley, we think, in this built-up area in the north of England. So it was very, very on the line. And even when we look at Stonehenge as representing Saturn in this model, Stonehenge, as you might know, has 30 or so stones creating the outer lintel stone circle.
Mm-hmm.
In its round of the zodiac, Saturn takes about 29, 30 years to do one round.
Yep, 29.
Going through that. Yep, so, and the 30th stone at Stonehenge is slightly smaller than the other lintel stones as well. It's called stone number 29, for those that want to look that up. So there seems to be a lot of symbolism in relationship to this ley.
Well, Saturn as a planet, as NASA's measured it with the Voyager flybys and then, of course, Cassini. I mean, it's just so amazing in a hyperdimensional physics perspective. Saturn is nothing like they expected, and it doesn't behave like their models have said. And, of course, they're baffled publicly anyway. Maybe they're not privately baffled, but publicly Saturn is really, really, really weird, wondrously weird, as it should be, because the rings are active. They're not passive. They're part of the hyperdimensional way that planets interact with the field. So Saturn is so bizarrely wondrous hyperdimensionally. Okay, next question. If you have the technology to measure the ley energies along the line, what happens to those energies when they encounter these monuments representing the planets?
Yes. I mean, we haven't measured the energy of that line.
Oh, darn.
But what we have done in terms of dowsing, for example, they do seem more energized. And I think the planetary positions also affect that line, because another...
When you say planetary position, you mean the real planets upstairs? As they're changing configuration, the line and the planetary representations along the line, they change?
That seems to be the case indeed, especially with conjunctions and oppositions.
Oh, how wondrous, how perfect.
Now, another astronomer friend of mine, he helps other authors as well, not just myself, called Rodney Hale. He has some really good software and can calculate, you know, the planets at any time. And what he did, because I said, when in prehistory would the planets have lined up, kind of symbolizing what was going on the ley below, if you see what I mean.
Right, like you have them all lined up like beads on a string from the sun out to Pluto, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Wow.
And was there a time in prehistory when that did occur?
Mm-hmm.
And according to Rodney Hale, it was around 2700 BC, which was the heyday, orthodox dating, of when those monuments were being constructed and being built.
Hmm.
Now, if they were already in existence and they're much older, let's say, they're older than that, then 2700 BC could have been a time where there was a big surge on that line, a big energetic.
There would have been, So did your friend calculate? Did your friend calculate previous cycles?
He did the one which was 2700 BC.
And the one before that?
The one before that, he didn't calculate.
Oh, darn. Why not? Why not?
Because we've... Okay. that indeed...
back in consonance with your friend who ducked a sample from Silbury Hill that's 12,000 years, which is about the same age as Göbekli Tepe.
Yes.
We've got to stop thinking of this history being all compressed into, you know, the canonical 6,000 years. Our real history is so much vaster and has been vigorously suppressed.
Well, indeed. I mean, even with recent carbon dating, which, as you know, can be inaccurate anyway from Stonehenge, two samples were taken by an archaeologist, and what came up was the orthodox date that's always being mooted, 2500 BC,
mm-hmm.
what anything over the planet seems to match that day, but a much, much older one was putting it way, way back to more like sort of 10,000 BC. And that was just from two bits of carbon from grain. So we know...
Hang on. Where were those samples taken? How far apart were they?
They were found in the same position beneath a blue stone at Stonehenge.
You mean they were side by side and they were that different in dates?
Yes, that's the intriguing thing.
Well, that means that one had been brought in from someplace else more recently. Because they, remember, the energy flows, it's not uniform. It swirls like in vortices and whatever. So you can have two materials that are separated by 20, 30, 40 feet. Think back to Lehner measuring the Great Pyramid, and they can have significantly major differing radiocarbon decay ages.
Yes, and what the archaeologists do, they will always choose the younger date.
Of course,
because
of course.
It fits their model. And incidentally, that was the archaeologist that did that, and it is widely reported there was these huge discrepancies with Tim DeVille and the late Jeffrey Wainwright. They were looking and investigating the blues, particularly the blue stones at Stonehenge, because Stonehenge is made of a variety of different stones, such as sarsen stones, which are the really big lozenger-shaped
right.
stones. And the trilithons, and the smaller stones that create an inner feature are the blue stones that came from Wales.
So these were like two grains of what, wheat?
Yeah.
Okay, and they were like side by side under a blue stone, right?
Yes.
And they had dates differing between 10,000 and 2,500 years.
Yes, one he said possible he printed in print it was 7,700 years before the present date. BP they call it sometimes in their dating system rather than sort of like BC. So we do have all of these discrepancies that can put the monument way back, which matches John Cowie's 12,000, which matches the oldest monuments in the world that are in Turkey that you've mentioned.
Göbekli Tepe,
wherever you're in Turkey or whether you're in the British Isles,
which just happens to be exactly one half of the precessional cycle, which is what drives the physics up and down, changing its, amplitude and changing its impact on everything, including human consciousness and biology. I wonder if those two samples side by side were deliberately put together by somebody thinking that in the future somebody would figure it out. I mean, really?
could well be.
Like a little tiny
museum,
like a little time capsule. Hey, guys, in the distant future, figure this one out. Which would throw everything we think about Neolithic cultures into a cocked hat.
Well, this is the thing with evidence coming out, whether it's from the archaeological model or whether it's from antiquarian report. It does always point out to a multi-faceted use of these monuments. I mean, Silbury Hill alone is a multi-faceted monument that has a lot going on. It's not just one thing. It can release light. It's on a huge lay. It represents the planet Earth. It was a seven-step pyramid. I mean, you have an awful lot going on with these monuments. I don't think they were just one thing or used as one thing at any one time. So that by itself and that lay is really very powerful because it seems to be activated, especially so round about the time of the winter solstice, which normally occurs on the 21st of December, sometimes on the 22nd of December. That seems to be a peak day where that line is activated. We've looked at over the years.
Well, the physics model says it should be. because it's at right angles to the rotation of the Earth. And on that day, we're in alignment between the Sun, the Earth, and the center of the galaxy with its 4 million solar mass black hole. It's all falling into place.
Yeah, I mean, it really does energize that. And also what's interesting about the winter solstice, when you come to some of the stones at Avebury that are in situ, that haven't been re-erected in concrete, because a lot of the Avebury stones have, the two massive entrance stones, they're really big. They weigh up to 60 to 80 tons. They are huge. One of them has a seat area, and it's called the Devil's Chair. It has a place where you can actually sit in and be like on a megalithic throne. It's huge. It has an area that also would have originally been in alignment to, if you sat in that chair, you'd have seen the midwinter sunrise. But today the Henge Bank is in the way.
Oh.
That's because the Henge Bank was extended 200 years ago. If you read Alexander Keeler's original archaeological report, he found that the Henge Bank was set back by about 30 feet. So if you put the Henge Bank back into its original position, what I discovered was, Richard, is that you'd be able to see the midwinter sunrise from that chair.
Sitting in
so
the catbird seat.
Sitting in the... Exactly. So, again, it's lined up.
Now, archaeologically, what does a throne, a seat, represent?
Well, a throne represents a seat of authority, of power.
Yeah, but who, specifically? Who?
Well, for the ruler at that time, a priest.
Well, all right, I'll give you one more clue. Egypt.
Egypt.
The hieroglyph of a
seat
of the throne represents Isis.
Isis. Oh, yes, she's depicted with the throne on her
yes,
head sometimes.
Yes, serious.
Yes.
And, of course, yes. Last night, you know, some of the folks that are tooling around, we now know from multiple sources are from Sirius, more family.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting connection.
The plot is getting very, very, very lumpy. Boy, wait till George joins us in a few minutes.
Yeah, so when we have a look at these monuments, even just from Stonehenge to Avebury and beyond, they're not just these arbitrary placements. They are, you know, representing a planisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the important thing, because, and there's more lines that go through Silbury than just that one as well. It's called a beacon monument, where you get numerous lines going through. So we don't just see, you have a major line, like the planetary Duke line, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that going through it, but imagine it being crisscrossed by a lot of other, you know, ley lines as well.
Like a network.
Crossing it, and
like a
network, yeah.
Mm.
Like a dartboard, almost. You know, it has numerous lines going through it, and beneath that as well, you will have a massive, massive aquifer as well. So below that, you've got a deep aquifer that gives off a spiral energy pattern called a geospiral as well, which is a dowsable image in the ground. It's like a surface pattern. It's what dowsers would be able to interpret. That's a very, very deep aquifer. So again, the placement of Silbury Hill is not arbitrary on many, many different levels. And same as that long barrow that housed that very unusual being, that too is on very unusual earth energies. So the ancients deliberately planted the barrow, placed the barrow rather, over spiral energy patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a huge ley that goes like north-south along that barrow, and it too is crossed by other leys as well.
Mm. Okay, here's a really, I'm sorry, this is unfair, I shouldn't do this, but I'll do it anyway. What happened to all the good stuff in the barrow around the weird guy? The skeleton?
The Yeah, well, whenever you have anything interesting happening around the Stonehenge environs, it's either in a no-go area because it's a military establishment surrounding Stonehenge.
Oh, how convenient. How wondrously convenient. National security rears its ugly head again.
And you can't go on there. It's a bit like Area 51. Civilians can't enter that.
The
so
perfect tool
kind
of censorship that no one questions.
Yes, exactly so. And it's on the periphery of what's called a danger zone. Quite a lot of the very interesting barrows are in the no-go zone. So what happened to the remnants of this being? Well, it was reported, and then they didn't know if they were put back or if they were taken out and have gone missing. Again, when you have these really interesting reports that challenge everything we know about our past, they tend to mysteriously just disappear or never be reported about. Same with the elongated skulls. If I hadn't gone to Cambridge and Oxford University to look at these skulls, nobody would have realized that there was elongated skulls in the British Isles because they are stored away in boxes. They're just stored away, Richard. And so where did they
go? I'm thinking of that great end scene from Indiana Jones. Remember that scene? The big warehouse?
No, I don't. Remind me.
Oh, the big warehouse where they put the ark after he'd gone through all that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the same. I mean, for instance, when I was in Cambridge, you have Stonehenge skulls in boxes on one side of the warehouse, just like Indiana Jones. Great analogy, Richard. And on the other side were all the skulls from Abydos, in Egypt.
Amazing.
I was looking at them, and I took a photograph of it as well, thinking there are hundreds of skulls. I'm not talking about one or two, Richard. I'm talking about box after box after box going up 20 feet high for as long as your eye can see.
Wow.
And they are not investigated because when I signed in to look for the elongated, I call it the High Queen of Stonehenge, nobody had seen her since the 1930s. I had to sign in. And I thought, this is astonishing.
Okay, we are at the top of the hour. We're going to be joined on the other side by Georgia Lambert, and my guest, Maria, will remain with us. I can't wait to hear their conversation. I mean, you begin to get a picture here now that there's a lot more in heaven and earth ratio than is dreamed of in your ancient archaeological philosophy, that there's been an active connection to our high-tech ancient history, our hyperdimensional using the field to enhance human occupation of the planet with maybe somebody else thrown in, relatives from where? If they were shorter and they had denser bones, would it be a real reach to say maybe they came from a higher gravity planet? Remember, the 800-pound gorilla armed with hyperdimensional physics and technology, can live almost anywhere it wants to. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Georgia Lambert is coming up when we return. And if you touch that dial now, well, I will be very disappointed.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone. It is now officially the other side of midnight here in the high desert in northern New Mexico, the land of enchantment. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, and she'll be joined shortly by Georgia Lambert. Maria is a very out-of-the-box pioneering archaeologist with an expertise in dowsing, in detecting these energies. And I'm telling you, Maria, something really weird and wondrous is coming up that I wonder if you're going to be measuring, probably with your selected tool of choice, which is dowsing, on literally Christmas Eve, on December 24th of this year. There is a square involving, that's an astrological term, a square involving Saturn and Uranus, which is exact the night of Christmas Eve grading into Christmas morning. And the moon is moving through a 60-degree angle, which is a sextile, and then it goes to a right angle, another square, across Christmas Day into the day after Christmas. And something, according to our best calculations, something is going to occur in that really crucial hyperdimensional window. So I would recommend strongly that you get to the nearest ley line or the nearest interesting monument or monuments plural, and you do some measurements in that time frame, because frankly, from everything we put together, something really amazing and wondrous could happen.
Yes, I will.
Okay, I believe we have been joined by Georgia. Are you there?
I am. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's still evening on your coast, but it's morning here, and it's really morning in England. Maria.
Hi, Maria.
Hi, Georgia. Hi.
Okay, I presume you've been able to listen for at least the last hour or so?
Yeah, just about an hour. In fact, when you were discussing Silbury, I quickly emailed both Richard and Kim Thea diagrams of the internal structure and the seven steps.
Oh, you found it. You got it. Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay,
oh, that's in your email.
We're wondering, did you send it to Kinthea?
I did send it to Kinthea's email, yes.
So let me refresh and see if she has been able to put it in your items. Okay, there we go.
I need to find my items.
Okay, you go to Fast Links under the banner on the guest page and click on your name. Versus Fast Links to Items, because you have so much stuff tonight, she had to put you on a separate page. So.
Yeah, but I'm getting the page from last week.
You are, yes, exactly, because I wanted you to quickly reprise the National Cathedral and why it's connected to all the amazingly cool stuff. You don't have to do a lot, just, you know, so people have the pictures to reference in terms of the connection.
Gotcha.
I try to be logical about this. We'll start at the beginning. Start with number one. We've been talking all evening about this bizarre conference, which was held on November 10th, which reeks of ancient connections and future ufology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought we would start with, why the hell did they hold this, of all places, at the National Cathedral? And now, of course, end of story, the National Cathedral is intimately connected to all of the stuff that Maria has been talking about for the last 2 hours. So start there.
Well, the National Cathedral is a true Gothic cathedral. It's not old, but it's based on the same architecture that we see all over Europe, which means that it's a tesseract, which is a fourth dimensional figure in three dimensions. So if you were going to...
A fourth dimensional cube.
Yes.
And a cube is two interlocked tetrahedrons, and the tetrahedron is basically, you know, the symbol of the physics. And Maria, the one thing I forgot to mention, there are only seven symmetry spins of a tetrahedron in three dimensions, which is why there's a seven-step pyramid hiding under Silver Hill.
Interesting.
It's so cool. It all is coming together.
It is.
Sorry, Georgia. Keep going.
That's okay. So if you were going to have a conference that opens this world to another world or dimension or level of being, a tesseract is the perfect architecture to do that in. But the interesting thing about this is that there are numerous connections between this cathedral and Glastonbury in England. We know that historically the United States is sort of a child of Britain, but there's a deeper esoteric connection as well. Too long to go into, but esoterically, every chakra, major, minor, and minute, has a higher correspondence within the head, which means that there is a heart center within the head. Glastonbury is this higher mystical heart center. It's interesting that in the Bible, there are two accounts of Jesus's birth. One is the one where you have the shepherds in the field with the announcing angels and, you know, the animals around the manger, that kind of thing. That's really the lower birth of the opening of the lower heart center, or the beginning of the spiritual path. The higher heart center is the account where the wise men show up with three gifts, symbolic of gold being the riches of the physical world, frankincense being incense that purifies the emotional or astral sphere, and myrrh, the bitterness of the mind. So there's a connection from this country, this national cathedral, to the higher heart in Britain, which is Glastonbury. And that connection is through the Saint Joseph of Arimathea. In our national cathedral, under the high altar at the first floor, is a chapel dedicated to Joseph of Arimathea, who was Jesus's uncle, who held Roman offices as well as a place in the Sanhedrin. So he was a pretty important guy. He was the one that supplied the tomb and possibly the material for the shroud. He is the one that's tied up with all of the legends with the Holy Grail. And just as St. Peter in Rome is the lower heart of Christianity, the outward church that sort of dropped its focus and became secular and political, the mystical line of Christianity, kind of headed by Joseph of Arimathea, has always been in place. Every religion around the world has an outer court and an inner court. And Joseph of Arimathea and his connection to the Grail saga represents the inner mysteries, or the inner court. And so I've got a couple pictures up there of the National Cathedral, St. Joseph's Chapel, a couple of stained glasses showing Joseph of Arimathea. Under that, on number 5, is a stone chair that's part of the St. Joseph Chapel that's made of the stone from Glastonbury Abbey. And, of course, a couple pictures down, there's the Moon Rock, where the conference took place, and some newer contributions to Gothic architecture, including the Darth Vader gargoyle. And on the grounds, there is a thorn tree between the St. Albans Boys' School and the National Cathedral, which is taken from a cutting from St. Joseph's staff that grew the thorn on Wirial Hill in Glastonbury, which in the last few years has been savaged. But there are other...
They're
cuttings of the tree on the Abbey grounds, which are protected, and that tree is still flourishing. And that kind of wraps it up from last week.
See, that wasn't hard.
So where
it's
do you want
interesting,
to...
Sorry, it's interesting to note that, you know, if I may, just to say that before the Glastonbury Abbey was built, there was the first church of all Christendom built by Joseph of Arimathea, and it was connected to the St. Michael ley line and the Mary Current that entwines that lay, and it was dedicated to St. Mary. And the geometry of that, according to the late John Michel, was that the dimensions were the same as Stonehenge. And if you take the diameter, which of the blue stone circle at Stonehenge, he claims, is 79.20, that's feet and inches, 79.20, instead of using feet, you now change that to 100 miles. You have the diameter of the earth encoded into the first church of Christendom, which was based on the dynamics of Stonehenge.
The story is that when the crucifixion took place and Joseph had to get out of town fast, he owned tin mines in Cornwall, and that's where he got all his money. He had his own fleet of ships and land in Cornwall. And the story is that Lazarus and Mary Magdalene went with him. They were dropped off in France. Lazarus became the first bishop there of Marseille. And some say that Mary, the mother of Jesus, also accompanied Joseph of Arimathea. And that first chapel, which it was built on as part of the Abbey grounds, and you can still see the site today. It has a St. Joseph's chapel there, which is underground like our St. Joseph's chapel in Washington. It was the first church dedicated to Mary because the veneration of the Virgin was not something that was widespread at that particular time. So there's lots of, I mean, we could spend months just talking about, you know, all of the interesting connections there. But the point is that our connection in this country to this esoteric lineage is through Joseph of Arimathea and Glastonbury. And without spending months on Glastonbury, I thought tonight I would just highlight a couple of points that might be interesting for people to know about and follow up on.
Okay, before you do that, let me kind of do a setup here. For someone who's kind of politically into this stuff and has been tracking NASA and the Congress and national space policy and all that, the idea that you would have the first major conference in Washington in the post-UFO disclosure era, held at the National Cathedral, not at the Kennedy Center, not on Capitol Hill, not at some hotel in downtown, but at the cathedral, you know, my, you know, bumps went ding, 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 ding. There's got to be a deeper set of levels and connections. And then Georgia hit me with these all these Glastonbury links that are both overt and covert and very, very Emily Dickinsonian. And then, of course, she said, oh, and by the way, do you know about the Glastonbury Zodiac? So we got a conference on outer space up to and including extraterrestrials. Ms. Haynes, step forward, please, and take a bow. And now we've got a Glastonbury Zodiac in an ancient landscape that Maria, for the last couple hours, has been regaling us with ley lines and structures dedicated to planets that light up in the physics when the right alignments, you know, take place. So this deep levels of connection between the terrestrial and the celestial, anchored now in modern politics as disclosure is about to be born in Washington, D.C., connecting all the way back to this ancient landscape of England, which is so immersed in this time and lure and lore. It's unmistakable. So, Georgia, you're on.
Well, when Joseph, again, after the crucifixion, when he came back to Britain, obviously and logically, because he owned land there, he was given, books say, are 12 hides of land by the king at that time, Arviragus. Now, it's not really clear what dimension a hide of land was. Most people think, you know, it was, you know, some sort of measurement like an acre or something like that. But there's another perspective, and that is that the 12 hides of land were the hides of the beasts that were the signs of this zodiac.
Oh, hides, H-I-D-E-S.
Exactly.
And 12, the number 12 is critical here, folks.
Yes, yes. And, of course, this whole area is amazing. So if you'll have your guests look at my pictures there.
We're down to number 12.
Number 12 is...
Which is very ironic, incredibly ironic.
If anybody wants more information, this is the classic work by Mary Kane on the Glastonbury Zodiac, and it has all kinds of fabulous pictures and little details that will just amaze you. So that's the book to go to. The next picture is a map of this particular zodiac, and we'll see several different pictures.
And when
this.
You click on them, they get much bigger.
Yes, and you'll need to do that. The zodiac itself is a little more than 12 miles across.
How many miles?
12.
Of course, of course.
And that is not including the outlying figure, which is called the Girt Dog, the Girt Dog of Langport. There's an old English Christmas carol, the Girt Dog of Langport, he burned his long tail, and we go singing wassail, wassail. At the very end of the dog's tail is a town called Wag. And so this zodiac is partly natural, and nobody knows how old, and partly man-made or man-enhanced.
Mm. Sorry, Georgia, let me interrupt.
Yes.
Maria, we have side views, interior views, and a perspective aerial oblique, all in sketches and diagrams, as number 33, courtesy of Georgia in Georgia's items, of Silbury Hill. So now you can see the conical pyramid under the hill in all its seven magnificent chalk layers.
If everybody scrolls down, you can see it there at the end of my pictures there.
Yes, I mean, I talked about that for some time. And just thinking about, you know, black dogs, again, if we go back to the great author of Geomancy, John Michell, he always said black dogs are associated with the guardians of ley lines. And the Gert dog is the guardian, if you will, that's how a lot of people see it over here, as being the guardian of the zodiac. And I had the great fortune of meeting Mary Kane once in Kingston. She found another zodiac there as well.
Yes, the Glastonbury Zodiac is not the only Zodiac found in Britain, but it's one of the largest and the most famous, certainly. Another thing is that in Celtic lore, there are three sacred animals, the dog, the roebuck, and the lapwing. The dog guards the secret. The roebuck hides the secret, and the lapwing disguises the secret. So we have the dog both guarding and keeping watch over the zodiac Glastonbury. The next picture, number 14, shows two different versions. Just like Alfred Watkins was the gentleman that sort of brought the whole idea of ley lines into modern thought, there was a woman named Catherine Maltwood that was credited with discovering the Glastonbury Zodiac, although there are certainly references to it in all kinds of works and songs going back much, much, much earlier. The picture number 14 shows the original one that Catherine Maltwood discovered, and the one that Mary Kane went a little further in elaboration. There's a couple of differences in the modern zodiac. Cancer in this old zodiac is a ship, not a crab. And this, of course, is the ship of initiation. We think of the ship that bore Arthur to Avalon to heal from his grievous wounds. The sign of Libra is a descending dove. And it's very interesting that, of course, the dove is associated with Isis, the Virgin Mary, the Holy Spirit. Here in the United States, on a lot of bumper stickers where they show evangelical descent of the Holy Spirit with this stylized dove, the stylized dove is the dove of Glastonbury. They probably don't know that, but that's the same shape. Capricorn is a unicorn in this old zodiac. Pisces has not only the two fishes, vertical and horizontal, but between them is Cetus the sea monster. And in some drawings, it looks very Nessie-like rather than fish-like, strangely enough. Virgo is shown as sort of a witch-like figure with the tall Welsh hat, holding a broom or a sheaf of corn, and she is pregnant, the pregnant virgin. But the interesting one for us is Aquarius. Now, remember, Aquarius is the water carrier, but it's an air sign. So in the Glastonbury Zodiac, Aquarius is a phoenix. And the eye of the phoenix is Glastonbury Tor. But in its beak is Chalice Well, which I'll talk about in a minute. So this phoenix is still a water carrier.
Interesting.
So the next picture, number 15, is an overlay of actual stars on top of the Glastonbury Zodiac. And it shows how perfectly the stars fit with these particular signs.
Wondrous. Do we have any idea, George, do we
ahead.
Have any idea how old the Zodiac is? Has anybody tried dating?
Not that I know of. Maybe Maria would know more than I on that. But some of it is ancient. And again, some of the man enhancements are a little newer. And of course, a lot of it is, you know, offset by modern farms and roads and things like that. But the older areas for instance, that are defined as streams and things like that, I don't know if there's been any dating as to how old this thing is. I do know that hints of it were certainly found in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, even though the knowledge of the zodiac was eclipsed for a while. You know, when Henry VIII was pulling down all of the Catholic cathedrals, he burned Glastonbury, which was a major place of pilgrimage, because Glastonbury, the Bishop of Glastonbury, wouldn't give up its secrets.
Hmm.
And of course, Henry, you know, immediately thought of treasure and things like that. But they were much more important secrets. And that bishop was taken to the top of the tower and beheaded. So
we have no idea how old the zodiac is.
You might be able to date the zodiac by, as it's been suggested by a few Brit researchers, by the stars Antares and
Aldebaran,
which anchor in Taurus and Scorpio into the zodiac, and some people suggest that it's around the age of Taurus because that would have been rising at the time. But that's just one.
Well, remember, if you look at, you know, Taurus was rising in this era like about 5,000 years ago, but you go back 26,000 years before that and 26,000 years before that. In other words, this dating always skewed toward the youngest date, whereas maybe they're much, much older, which is what I strongly suspect.
There's a couple of other things too, and we'll get to those in a minute in my pictures. But the carving pattern on Glastonbury Tor, which is the Eye of the Phoenix, is a maze that we find on coins from Crete, ancient Crete.
Okay.
So that's also a helpful, you know, thing to date. The next picture, number 16, is a Google Earth with the zodiac overlaid, so you can again get a sense of how big this thing is. Again, we could go into each sign and find, you know, the names of towns and places that absolutely fit, you know. Obviously, we don't have time to do that this evening, but I've got a couple here. Number 17 is Aries, and it really needs to be rotated horizontally. And Aries is the
partial. I'll tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's hold it there. My guest this morning is Georgia Lambert. We're talking about the Glastonbury Zodiac and the connection between Glastonbury, this ancient landscape connected now obviously to the stars and to the zodiac against which the planets swirl and which modulates the physics between dimensions. And the UFO conference just held at the National Cathedral, which is demonstrably, overwhelmingly, redundantly connected to the Glastonbury landscape. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The other side is midnight.com.
talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment for your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to the last half hour of the Sunday night program, The Other Side of Midnight, here from the Land of Enchantment. And Georgia was in the middle of narrating the Glastonbury Zodiac connected in the landscape to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and a UFO conference that could have been held anywhere, but was held there. Okay.
My wife got me this weird...
Sorry about that, guys. Okay, Georgia, you're on.
Yes. We were looking at number 17, the sign of Aries. Again, it needs to be rotated clockwise a bit. But this, of course, Aries is the ram or lamb. And this turns out to be the prototype of the paschal lamb, which is the next picture that I have. This is a very important Christian symbol. It was also a Templar symbol. And strangely enough, one of the intact Templar churches still around is in London, which is Temple Church in London. It still is a functioning church. And it's right next to the Inns of Court, which is the site of Francis Bacon's hangout when he was plotting colonization of the New World. He and his cronies hung out at the Inns of Court right around Temple Church. And it's interesting that the inner buildings of the Inns of Court, on their cornerstones, they have the carved figure of a Pegasus hitting a stone and water pouring from the stone. But the outer buildings of the Inns of Court on their cornerstone have this paschal lamb, which is the sign of Aries and relates in mundane astrology to the head. The next, and again, we could spend, you know, a month on each of these signs. What you see on the ground is just stunning in relationship to the sign itself. The sign of Gemini, the two twins, are very interesting. You can see that in page 19. One twin looks more like the Western twin, almost a Jesus figure, and the other is sort of sideways in a sort of lotus posture, sitting
kind of like Buddha.
Yes, at the paws of the lion there. And number 20 shows you, I've got the red outline of the Western twin that looks kind of like Jesus. The hands over the head are bound with the palms together. And the face, half of it's cut away by farmland. But if you enlarge it, you can see that there's the hair, the eyes, half a mustache and beard, which is depicted by forest trees on the face.
So if these are really ancient geoglyphs, landforms, there must have been some heritage where somebody kept, you know, the gardener kept upkeep.
Yeah.
They kept being maintained, and maybe within families or priesthoods that were families, or in other words, some connected lineal descendants followed the ritual to maintain the forms?
One would think and obviously assume, again, you know, the natural things like rivers and stuff would have been there. When we're talking about, you know, ancient British towns, you know, some of those little towns have been there since time out of mind and would have kept those particular places. The next one, the number 21, is Aquarius, and it doesn't show up real great, but there's a couple of things in Aquarius that are important. Again, Glastonbury Tor, which is number 22, shows you this great conical hill, and you can see in the little picture there the ridges on the side of the Tor, and the picture following that shows the maze, a three-dimensional maze on top of Glastonbury Tor. And this particular maze is found on coins in Crete. This maze is also found at Tintagel, which is traditionally the birthplace of Arthur, well, one of the birthplaces of Arthur. Wales has got a few.
We're talking King Arthur.
A few claims.
King
yes,
Arthur, yeah.
King Arthur. There's at Tintagel, there's a cave called Merlin's Cave that has this Cretan maze drawn on it. And, you know, in Gothic cathedrals, these were temples for the masses. And everything about this temple was geared to have an effect upon not only the consciousness, but the subtle body of the practitioners that by law had to go to mass every week, you know, until the Reformation. So, you know, the music that was played at particular times of year, the stained glass windows, which they found that the gold flakes in stained glass windows, when sunlight comes through it, it has an antibacterial effect.
Oh, my.
On the people inside. It's like, you know,
oh,
medieval nanotechnology.
Oh, my God. By the way, are there seven layers on the Tor? I'm counting seven.
Yeah.
Lucky seven.
There you go. So, you know, there's a lot in the architecture of a true Gothic cathedral that affects the subtle body. And, you know, when we think of mazes, like, for instance, one of the most famous is the maze at Chartres Cathedral. Chartres, of course, was built on top of one of the greatest Druid colleges on the continent. Mazes means that you turn your body so that as you walk the maze, you face this stained glass window or that particular carving, or, you know, it's sort of a mystical journey. And everything within the landscape of the cathedral facilitates that journey. I've always thought it would be a really neat thing if we could superimpose some of these mazes on the anatomy of the brain and follow the mazes to see what areas of the brain are being activated at
sequence. Interesting. Yes, yes.
So maybe somebody will have the technology to do that one of these days. But to walk the maze on the Tor, I've done it quite a few times. It takes, to do it properly, it takes about 4.5 hours. And that's if it's not raining. because when it rains, the sheep leavings on the side get very slippery.
Slippery, yes.
So the Tor is interesting for so many different reasons. It's said that there was once a standing stone circle on the top of the Tor, but the Christians broke it up and used the stone to make the St. Michael's Church that's on the top. But an earthquake came along somewhere in the 500s and leveled the church, but left the tower. So the Druids still have their standing stone on top of Glastonbury Tor, in a way. But it's said that the Tor was also the domain of the king of the underworld, or the king of the fairies, Gwyn ap Nudd. And And sometimes you can still hear fairy bells in quiet moments on the tour, among other things.
Mm.
Of course, it's dedicated to St. Michael, as most high places are. The merry places are sacred wells, often healing wells, and the high places are St. George and St. Michael. Which brings us to what's in the beak of the phoenix in the Glastonbury Zodiac, and that is Chalice Well. Chalice Well is a very, very ancient well. It's consistently putting out about 25,000 gallons a day. It's amazing. It's known for its healing properties. One subject that we might go into some night is the savior, really, of Chalice Well, a fellow by the name of Wellesley Tudorpole, who saved Chalice Well from becoming a brewery.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, he was...
Which needs a lot of fresh water.
Yes, he was a soldier during World War One, and long story, but he saved the lives of the family of the founder of the Baha'i faith. He was also a friend of Churchill and was responsible for the silent minute during World War II. And he founded a trust, and so Chalice Well is now protected. The waters of Chalice Well are slightly radioactive and high in iron content, which turn it sort of red, and it's traditionally been called the Blood Spring.
Mm.
And it's on a hill right across from the Tor, and there's several levels of it. Number 24 is the high level of it, and you can see the opening there, and that goes down quite a ways. The next picture is where the water actually comes out, and you can see the red coloring there in number 25. It's the water's coming out of a lion's mouth.
I was just going to say, the pussycat is interesting.
Yes, and of course, the lion is associated with the heart center, and this is where you can take the waters away. There's another level that I didn't show, but the bottom level is the Chalice Well pool, which is in the shape of a vesica piscis, which also it has to do with the union of a higher and lower world. And they still have lots of ceremonies and baptisms and things that go on in the Chalice Well gardens.
It looks like number 24, the well in that first picture, also has a vesica piscis on an iron lid that you close.
Yes, it
okay.
does. Number 27.
27 is a sketch of, there it is.
Yes.
There it is. Okay.
And you can see what it looks like on the surface, that photo that we just saw. But then what's underneath is this chamber and this chair or seat or something strange. May have been used for initiations. We don't know. But it's extremely old. And the next picture is a painting that I did in the 80s that donated to the Chalice Well Trust, and it's they have all rights of reproduction for it.
Oh, my gosh.
But
you
can see...
You are so talented.
Oh, thank you.
Wow.
it was really fun doing that painting. I started going to Glastonbury 40 years ago. God, how did that happen? Anyway... so it's one of their posters and cards that they do. Now, the interesting thing about the Blood Spring of Chalice Well is it's right across the street from the White Spring. Now, the source of water for the Blood Spring at Chalice Well is completely different than the source of water for the White Spring. The Blood Spring, its source goes up into the Mendip Hills and Wookiee. By the way, weird trivia side point, George Lucas named one of his critters the Wookiee.
Yes.
And another one of his critters, Tauntaun. This was the big snow kangaroo thing,
mm-hmm.
called a Tauntaun. Wookiee and Tauntaun are two places on either side of Glastonbury.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah. So right across the lane, it's not even a two-lane street. It's like a little country lane. But there's this little country lane distance between the Red Spring, the Blood Spring, and the White Spring. And the White Spring has a high calcium content, and it gives this whitey deposit. And it's inside and underneath the ground. So in physical dents, we have this outpicturing of the alchemical red and white,
mm-hmm.
or the marriage of sun and moon, or masculine and feminine. And even during World War II, Wellesley Tudor Pole with the Chalice Well and the Silent Minute, and Dion Fortune had her little house right at the foot of the Tor at the White Spring. So we have these two esoteric warriors, really, during World War II, right across the lane from one another.
Amazing.
Again, red and white, masculine, feminine. It's amazing. And there is some speculation that perhaps in ancient times there was a place further on down that has yet to be discovered where the Druids allowed the Red Spring and the White Spring to mingle.
Oh.
That hasn't happened, that discovery hasn't happened yet, but perhaps it will. You can see a couple of pictures there of different areas of the White Spring in my pictures.
Including an interesting vortex, number 29.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting. It's in a building that was made in the 1800s, and you go in the building, and underneath there's this sort of cave where the water comes out. Very similar to, you know, the cave underneath Bath where the mm-hmm. sulfur spring comes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, very amazingly powerful. So we've got the Red Spring and the White Spring, very alchemical. You know, in Freemasonry, they talk about, and Rosicrucianism as well, they talk about the divine marriage in the upper room. And the upper room is, of course, this room at the top of 33 stairs. Mystically, the 33 stairs are the 33 vertebrae of the spinal column. And the room at the top of the stairs is an area in the brain called the third ventricle, where the pituitary gland and the pineal gland live. And these relate to the ajna center in front of the forehead and the crown chakra above the physical head. And at certain very advanced stages of meditation, when the crown chakra and the ajna center are activated in tandem, they produce effects on the pineal and the pituitary gland. Now, within the human body, the cerebrospinal fluid is manufactured in two big areas on either side of the brain called ventricles. This cerebrospinal fluid pools in the center of the head, and then it moves down a narrow conduit to the back part of the brain, and then down the spinal column, and then back up to be reabsorbed in the head. That takes about 28 days. So,
which happens to be the orbit period of the moon.
Yes, yes. So, and also, you know, the breath of the earth. So we are geared, not just the feminine cycle, but we are actually geared to harmonize with these greater rhythms.
Hmm.
Now, the thing is that, again, there are two levels of the birth of the Christ consciousness, the beginning opening of the heart and the adult son born within the head at a later stage of the path. One of the Western symbols for the crown chakra was a unicorn. And the story of the unicorn is that it lived in this forest where this stream exists, which is poison. It's poison for all the other beasts. So when the unicorn dips his head in the water, his horn touches the water and heals the waters and makes it safe for all the other beasts to drink. So when the Christ consciousness, the unicorn consciousness, is born within the head at a certain level of development, the pituitary and pineal glands release new hormones and essences into the cerebrospinal fluid, which then circulates down the spinal column where all the other chakras funnel into the spine, and the waters are changed and healed for all the other beast setters below the head to drink. And so we've got, with this interplay of the white spring and the blood spring, an outer manifestation of some very real inner mysteries that happen in consciousness at certain stages of the path. And the final couple pictures there, Glastonbury Abbey grounds. Maria was talking earlier about the Michael and Mary lines going right through there, right through the high altar area. And the final picture is the St. Joseph's Chapel there at Glastonbury, underneath the ground, which is a twin or echo of the one in our National Cathedral.
You notice the arch?
Which arch?
The one in St. Joseph's Chapel.
The big one, or the one right over the chapel itself?
No, the big one.
It's a typical Gothic arch.
It's a portion of what's called a relu triangle, which is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional tetrahedron.
Well, there you go. Two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional thing, and the tesseract, a three-dimensional representation of a four-dimensional thing.
Exactly, yes, yes. Okay, we've got about 6-7 minutes here. I want you to both expostulate extemporaneously what the hell is the connection between Washington, a obvious admission that UFOs are real, their connection to us somehow, and this landscape.
Well, I mean, this is the connection, as above, so below. You know, we are related to the stars. And all throughout the globe are remembrances of that. Some more obvious than others.
Can we be a little more specific? See, I'm thinking that there's something that's connecting our literal history, who we are. These various beings, remember the long-headed guys and the round-headed guys and this alien or ET being that appears in the midst of them, and that this is all not by chance. They chose that cathedral because that was the link planned when this is supposed to come out to be the focal point connecting these two pieces of real estate.
Well, Washington, D.C. is the head center or crown chakra of the nation, and the cathedral is at the highest point within that particular area. So, if you were going to bring in something from a higher or different dimension, you would want to bring it in. First and foremost, it would make its appearance at the highest possible frequency of the receiving entity, and that would be the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C.
Maria?
Well, I think on Glastonbury Tor, you have the Mary and Michael Earth Currents, and they wind around and they meander around the Tor, and it's symbolized where Mary creates like a cup area and Michael goes into that it was sexual union of where things can be born of worth and merit. So things can be born on the phoenix, something, you know, wonderful and new. So I think the symbolism of that is to, with the UFOs, is to make it birth it into the consciousness of humanity, get us all used to the fact. And Glastonbury as well was its own country, like the city of London. And that's why Henry VIII wanted to ransack it. It was rich and it was its own country, because within that own country, again, people used to pilgrimage there to get healing and to help manifest things in their life. So I think Glastonbury will help manifest the consciousness of extraterrestrials.
Bingo. Who in this model, our model, is family? I think, guys, we're talking family.
Yes.
And how ancient the family is and how widespread the family is. And we're just one part of, remember Neil Armstrong and that very mysterious wording, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. We're in this model, we're man, but all our relatives out there, the humanoid beings that suddenly mainstream astrobiology is, I mean, did you see that a couple of days ago published that, oh, the humanoid form could be everywhere? We're not looking at intelligent spiders or dolphins or whatever. We're looking at humanoids, humans in the you know, cultural parlance. They're getting us ready for the family, the reintroduction to the family, I think.
Well, I think it was very significant that they not only had it at the cathedral, but pretty close to right under that window with the moon rock in it.
Yes. Oh, gosh. It's wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels. Okay, couple of minutes. Maria, did we leave anything out of what you wanted to say tonight?
No, I think we've covered it, really, because, you know, it was about looking at the monuments through what they could visually, how we could visually see them with light, and also remembering the ancestors, the Long Skull people, and possibly the direct evidence of an extraterrestrial being within the Stonehenge environs.
And if we only knew where he or she went, where did they take that
yes.
that skeleton? What box is it lying in Indiana Jones' vault? Georgia, what
yes.
do you think? What do you think is going to happen next? Like big possibilities on Christmas Eve.
Your guess is as good as mine, Richard. If I had that kind of intuition, I would be a rich woman today.
Well, you are rich.
Certainly, you know, the physics is lining up for possibilities. Now, whether humanity takes those possibilities or not, you know, that's always choices that we make. But as you say, the surf's up and it's time to catch our boards, don't you think?
What a wonderful way to end. Hey, guys, I want to thank you so much, Maria Wheatley and Georgia Lambert. You play so well together. You have definitely inspired me. And as I said, next week, maybe by Saturday, I'll be able to talk about the next phase of the story, because there will be a next phase. I'm just not sure that we're going to be ready to unveil it in time. So until next week, same time, same bat channel, The Other Side of Midnight is going away for 7 days, actually six, and we'll be back. So until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone, and keep looking up.